just paging through your handy copy of the Communist Manifesto, you'll see it right there in Marx's list of 10 necessary precursors to a communist workers' paradise. The progressive income tax sits proudly at number 2, right behind the abolition of private property, by the way. I have a headline for you. The world is flattening. Investor's Business Daily, September the 4th, 2007. The headline says, in America, cutting rates is an ideological issue. In the former Soviet satellites of Europe, it is increasingly not an issue at all. So obvious is it that it gives people better lives. As nations around the world have learned the value and inherent fairness of a consumption-based tax system, they've also learned that corporate taxation, or the lack thereof, plays a huge role in economic growth. Countries around the world are now engaged in friendly combat on the field of tax competition. Ireland, in recent years, has been one of the clear winners in this battle. After Ireland reduced its top corporate tax rate from 50% to 12.5% and took other steps to simplify its tax code, the Irish economy, led by its jobs market, promptly exploded. Other European countries took notice. In the quest for more jobs and improved economic conditions, their average corporate tax rate has fallen by a third since 1992. The United States now ranks second behind Japan for the highest corporate tax rate in the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. In September of 2007, as we were working on this book, President Bush suggested a reduction of U.S. corporate tax rates. The Treasury Department started a discussion about reducing our corporate tax rates to attract jobs, such as the emerging economies have done. Perhaps the European message is getting through, because the Democrat who chairs the House Ways and Means Committee said the idea was actually worth studying. There are two lessons here. One, if cutting corporate tax rates leads to economic growth and new jobs, imagine what would happen if the fair tax were enacted and corporate tax rates were cut down to zero. Two, the parties can work together on this as long as it doesn't become a mindless partisan slugfest. Europe also offers some rather stark lessons in the impact of high income taxes levied on workers. For decades in Europe, just as in the United States, more work equaled higher taxes. The taxation became so onerous that many Europeans simply refused to work more than 30 or 35 hours a week. Not going to do it. The diminishing returns from higher tax rates made the extra effort not worthwhile. Many Americans just assumed that European workers were lazy, not up to the standards of our own exalted work ethic. Once their tax rates were lowered, that theory was dashed. Punish harder-working people by making them pay much higher taxes, and they'd just as soon stay home and tend their garden. Reward the extra work by allowing them to keep more of their own money, and you start hearing that hi-ho, hi-ho, it's off to work we go thing. Demands for and promises of a shorter work week seem to be a feature of virtually all European political campaigns. Or they were, anyway, until the advent of Nicolas Sarkozy. Sarkozy, the newly elected president of France, has come up with a rather interesting idea that changed this equation and, we hope, has opened some eyes. Sarkozy has proposed allowing French workers to work as many hours as they choose, but, now here's an idea, requiring them to pay income tax only on the first 35 hours of work every week. The rest would be tax-free. Can you imagine what would happen to the sacrosanct 40-hour work week in the United States if American workers could suddenly work and get paid for more than those 40 hours free of any federal taxation? Now take it a step further. Imagine how eager to work and produce American workers would be if this provision were rolled back to the point where they weren't taxed for the first hour, let alone the 40th. there would be a lot of people driving home from work in the dark. As more and more Americans get behind the fair tax, that discussion can be turned from reducing corporate taxes to eliminating them altogether. This is Chapter 5, The Merits of the Fair Tax. As we were completing this book, our nation was going through some difficult times in terms of the economy, jobs, trust in government, immigration, and our standing internationally. Now we find ourselves in the middle of an election year in which all of these issues are being hotly debated. One of the most amazing things about the fair tax is that it confronts and addresses virtually every one of those issues, some very comprehensively. Primarily among them, of course, is the economy. The fair tax was designed to confront economic forces that have been and continue to be eroding the firm foundation of America's economy. But that's just a start. As we've seen, the fair tax touches on many of the biggest debates raging in America today. Let's cover some of them. International competition. How can we keep our remaining jobs in America while bringing home some of the jobs that have fled our tax system? Class warfare. How can we fund the necessary and legitimate functions of our federal government in a fair and equitable manner while ensuring that the other guy is always paying his fair share? Then there's big government. How can we show the American people how much their government is actually costing them and create the simplicity and privacy in our tax system that all Americans want and all Americans deserve? Then there's immigration. Are immigrants stealing our jobs or working for us to make us money? How many legal immigrants do we want? How can we move from the lawless and uncontrolled situation we have now to a system where our laws are honored and immigrants actually seek to assimilate and become a part of the American family? Another issue, Social Security and Medicare. How can we avoid bankrupting the current generation with higher taxes to ensure that these programs will be there for our children and grandchildren? And then there's China. Is it engaged in currency manipulation or fair trade? How can we make our economic relationship with this growing economy work fairly for both parties? Every one of these issues is currently being debated on Capitol Hill and by candidates for federal office at all levels. The amazing thing is that there is a single tax bill out there that could address so many of these issues and go a long way toward solving every one of them. That, of course, is the fair tax. Now let's focus on immigration. I cannot discuss the issue of immigration on my radio show, and John Linder can't field a question about immigration at a town hall meeting without passions on both sides really flaring. But one thing few people expect is that the solution to our immigration problem could possibly lie in the pages of the Fair Tax Act. Now, how would that work? Once again, if we can eliminate taxes on capital and labor and create a border adjustable tax system that prevents our tax costs from being shipped overseas and the price of goods and services created in the U.S., our country would become an 800-pound economic gorilla. We would become unbeatable in the world marketplace. No longer would other nations, other economies, be taking business and jobs away from the U.S. economy by enacting their own valuable tax reform and simplification measures. As these nations have enjoyed steady gains, we have distracted ourselves with a cacophony of politicians from both sides of the aisle yammering about their favorite ideas for using our federal tax code to punish people they don't like while rewarding people and industries they do. If we want to remain competitive in the global economy, this nonsense has to stop. The fair tax stops it cold. Once we enact the fair tax, companies will rush to our shores to build manufacturing facilities so that they can sell into that global economy with no tax component in their price. And then what happens? Jobs. New jobs. Lots of jobs. And an increasing demand for new workers. This principle has been recognized by the nation's highest economic authorities. After a meeting a few years ago to talk about the fair tax, Treasury Secretary John Snow looked over his shoulder as he left Congressman Linder's office, and he said, "You have just proposed the biggest magnet for capital and jobs in history." He was right. Sadly, he wasn't the Treasury Secretary for much longer after that, but he was right. We have a 4.5% unemployment rate in the U.S. For years, it's been said that a 5% unemployment rate was essentially full employment. So where can we expect to find new workers for factories and businesses? And that's where immigration comes into the picture. The fact is, we don't have a sufficient pool of available labor in the United States to satisfy the job growth that would result from implementation of the fair tax. As companies move operations and jobs to the U.S. for their economic advantage, we're going to have to move workers in to fill those jobs. We'll be forced to allow more immigration from Europe. We'll be forced to expand the H-1B visas for high-tech talent. And, yep, we're going to have to look for more workers from Latin America. We must acknowledge that our non-citizen population has not been met warmly by a broad spectrum of the American people. This antipathy is not based on ethnicity, and it's certainly not based on the lack of a work ethic. The American people just don't like the idea that these illegal immigrants broke our laws to come here and continue to break our laws by staying and working here. Worse yet, we resent the fact that these illegal immigrants have become a drain on our social service systems funded by taxpayers, and that they aren't paying their share of the taxes needed to fund the systems they're using. To top it off, we aren't all that thrilled that so many politicians refuse to address the situation for fear of losing voter support from various minority voting blocs. All valid points, and all addressed by the fair tax. You'll remember that under the fair tax, every household receives a prebate at the beginning of every month. That prebate is a payment from the government equal to the amount of fair tax the household would be expected to spend during the ensuing month on the basic necessities of life. This prebate will vary depending not on income, but on the size of the household. It is designed to untax every single household in this country up to poverty-level spending. Now, that is the amount of spending necessary for a given-sized household to buy the essentials as determined by the Department of Health and Human Services every month. Now, what does this have to do with illegal immigration? Well, hold on. Here's the key. If you're in this country illegally, no matter how much or how little you earn, you don't get the prebate. The prebate is only for legal residents of this country. Now, putting aside our justifiable anger at the arrogance of people who think they have a right to enter into and work in our country illegally, and the even more infuriating arrogance of the politicians who enable them, isn't it in America's best interest to have immigrants come to our shores, work to grow our economy, pay taxes, and seek to become Americans, as Europeans and others did for two centuries? Well, we think so. We think the prebate will give immigrants an incentive to come here legally. Those who have done so and who have gone through the necessary legal steps, they tend to view illegal immigration the same way American citizens do. They feel they have a stake in their new country, and they are just as adamant about protecting it as we are. They buy food and cars and equipment, and they pay their fair share of taxes just as you do. Our schools and hospitals are their schools and hospitals, and they oppose their misuse just like you do. Legal immigrants want our borders to be protected, but they also understand why others want to join them here. The happy result of the fair tax is it'll help bring us in qualified new legal immigrants from around the world. While we're talking about immigration, let's address foreign tourism. As America under the fair tax becomes the world's predominant tax haven for business, it will also become the world's predominant tourist destination, attracting increasing numbers of tourists from Europe, Asia, and elsewhere. So guess what happens when these tourists spend their euros, their yens, their pesos, and other currencies on admission to Walt Disney World and snow globes featuring the Empire State Building. You got it. Right there in the price of those items. They're fair tax. These tourists will take their pictures and memories home and leave behind no small amount of money to help fund the operations of our imperial federal government, including our Social Security and Medicare programs. Are you taking all of this in? Yeah, it makes sense, doesn't it? And all of this from a 133-page tax bill. Impressive, don't you think? Now let's talk for a minute about transparency. By transparency, we mean the ability of average Americans to have some realistic sense of how much of the money they earn is being used to fund the operations of our federal government. As we pointed out a couple of years ago in the Fair Tax Book, transparency certainly isn't a part of our current structure. Very few wage earners in America today actually know how much they earn. If you don't believe us, just ask your neighbor how much they earn. They're likely to tell you what they take home. Take home? What about the money you left with your employer? What about the income taxes, the Social Security taxes, the Medicare taxes? You earned that money too, didn't you? Though you're barely aware of it. That's not tax code transparency, folks. Transparency means knowing what you've earned and knowing how much of what you've earned you're giving to the federal government. Transparency is seeing that entry for fair tax on every sales receipt you pocket whenever you buy something. Transparency means knowing how much the other guy is paying, and thus being able to judge whether or not he's paying his fair share. Transparency means knowing how much you're paying, and thus having better information about whether you're truly getting out of government what you're putting in. Are there downsides to tax code transparency? Oh, yeah. Yeah, you bet there are. I mean, not for you, but there's downsides. The downsides are reserved for bureaucrats trying to spend your tax dollars as they see fit. If you make your living in that big domed building at the end of the National Mall in Washington, D.C., transparency would mean not just that your constituents would have a clear understanding of what they're paying, but it would also mean that they would have a keener sense of how you're spending that money. Under the fair tax, no longer could expenditures or vote-buying programs be funded by hidden little taxes that affect only a very few. No more could one group of voters and taxpayers be played off against another group to gain favor from one at the expense of the other. Instead, people would see clearly that their tax system is inherently fair and no longer fall victim to tax code demagoguery. Good for us. Maybe not so good for the political class. The fact that fair tax principles haven't already been passed into law is an indication of failure at every level of politics and in every party. It's also an indication of the fear most politicians feel at the thought of a tax system without all of those little cute hiding places they love to manipulate for their own benefit. You'll probably hear this from us again. But passing the fair tax would constitute the biggest transfer of power from government to the people in the history of this republic. In case you haven't noticed it, some politicians aren't all that fond of the idea of transferring power. But remember, they're not the ones that get to make that choice. It's up to us. We hire these people. It is your right to let them know that there are conditions on their continued employment, passage of the fair tax being one of them. The issue of transparency received a rush of attention in Washington recently, not on the taxation side, but on the spending side. The debate was over what's called earmarking, the practice of inserting specific legislative language into a bill to direct a specific amount of money to a specific project. Let's say a congressman or senator wants to build a new bridge in San Francisco. The federal government sends literally hundreds of millions of dollars to California for the state to use on general transportation projects. But that congressman or senator has no way of guaranteeing that the politicians in California will choose to spend the appropriate amount of money on their particular bridge project. So the solution? The congressman or senator inserts a specific sentence in the bill that provides the hundreds of millions of dollars for that one project. The sentence might read, X million shall be used to repair slash build a bridge at Y location in San Francisco. Sometimes funding for such earmarks comes out of the pot of money a state was going to receive anyway. Sometimes it's added to a state's allocated funds. Earmarks aren't limited to transportation projects, of course. They can be used for literally anything, a new gymnasium for a high school, a new golf course for a military base, a study on the effects of tanning beds, a study on the mating habits of prairie dogs, a study on breast cancer, and the list just goes on and on. Now, what does this have to do with taxation? Close your eyes and ponder this example. Imagine the wealthiest family you know. Now imagine the poorest. Then imagine that Congressman Snored is going to put language into the next housing bill to help these two families. For the poorest family, Congressman Snored inserts language to provide $1,500 in annual housing assistance. For the wealthiest family, Congressman Snored inserts language to provide $21,000 in annual housing assistance. Now tell us truly, how do you feel about this earmark? You know that we, your authors, don't like to pick on the wealthy. We admire hard work and success. We value the contribution of the wealthy in building businesses to employ our neighbors, putting money in our banks for other entrepreneurs to borrow so that they can follow their own version of the American dream. But come on, does this earmark really pass your fairness test? Putting the concept of fairness aside, this earmark doesn't pass the smell test because the government doesn't have any business handing out housing money to people who don't need it, whether or not it has any business handing out money at all is a different debate for a different day. The amazing thing is this. This little fable is actually a true story, except for the Congressman Snored part. How on earth did it happen? Well, for one reason, this wasn't a spending earmark hidden in a spending bill. It was a collecting earmark sitting right out there in the open in a tax bill. The earmark is known as the home mortgage interest deduction. That's right. We'll bet most of you were outraged by the real-life example above, but our instincts also tell us that most of you are somewhere between ambivalent and thrilled about the home mortgage interest deduction. Why the dichotomy? We suspect that it is because the government has become very shrewd at playing games with your money. Even though the $21,000 value of the home mortgage interest deduction comes right out of the same pot at the U.S. Treasury that writing a $21,000 government check to the family would, it somehow feels different, doesn't it? In one case, it means letting the wealthy family keep more of its own money when it files its taxes on April 15th. In the other, it means taking $21,000 out of the U.S. Treasury and mailing it to the wealthy family. $21,000 of money that was sent in by hardworking families of all economic stripes. The former may sound fair and appropriate. The latter must sound bad. But we promise you they're functionally exactly the same thing. At the end of the day, in either case, the U.S. government has $21,000 less in its bank account than it otherwise would. Given its rampant spending, the government either needs to tax everyone else a bit higher to cover that $21,000, or it needs to take out yet another IOU that will in turn be passed along to our children and grandchildren. So do you see now why this concept is so important? For decades, Congress has disguised spending projects as tax cuts, projects that would never survive as spending line items, such as the home mortgage interest deduction, are readily embraced when they show up in the tax code. Rather than send everybody a check, we just let them add a line on their tax form. Much easier. So much so that these tax expenditures, as they are known in Washington, have grown to almost $1 trillion a year. How much is that? Well, let's put it this way. It's almost as much money as the government spends each year on all discretionary spending programs combined. Think about that. The government spends nearly as much money through special lines in the tax code as it does in all of the lines of discretionary spending in the budget. So is this starting to sink in? I hope so. The fair tax would prevent politicians from spending money by inserting special lines in income tax returns, because there wouldn't be any income tax returns. Maybe another real-life example would help. One former chairman of the Senate Finance Committee has said that he opposes the fair tax because it would make it impossible to help our friends in the business community. Now, just what did he mean by help our friends in the business community? The answer offers an excellent example of how tax transparency might not be a good thing for some elected officials. Here's how it might work. You may have noticed how excited everybody is about producing ethanol from corn these days, so much so that farmers are planting corn instead of other row crops. So much corn is going to the ethanol refinery that we're seeing increases in the cost of milk, beef, chicken, and pork because the producers of these animals have to pay more for feed. Even tortillas in Mexico have tripled in cost. Oh, the humanity. How is this possible? Why is it happening? Very simple. The tax code now subsidizes the production of ethanol to the tune of 51 cents a gallon. Add to that the tariff of 54 cents a gallon on imported ethanol, and you have a tax code that's helping corn farmers and hurting the rest of us. This is just one more line on somebody's income tax return, an earmark on the tax side of the federal ledger, not the spending side. If the ethanol subsidies were on the spending side of the ledger, rather than hidden in the tax code, the ethanol headlines would read differently. You would know these subsidies exist, because there'd be a specific appropriation to pay for them. With the fair tax, you'd know exactly what you were paying the federal government, and exactly how the federal government is spending your dollars. Good for you, bad for the politicians, who might fear that transparency might have an effect on the way you vote. As long as every American individual and business is required to fill out a tax form every year, distributing cash through the tax code will continue to be easy and pervasive. But what would happen if we didn't require every individual to fill out a tax form? In fact, what if, as the fair tax goes, we decreed that no individual would ever fill out a tax form again? How would that $1 trillion in additional spending, the stuff that's hidden on the tax side of the ledger, how would it be disguised then? Answer, it wouldn't be. There you go, folks. Tax transparency. As these examples demonstrate, our present tax code does far more than just raise revenue for the necessary functions of government. It's both a revenue-raising tool and a political tool. No country or economy is well served by a tax code that lends itself to manipulation for purely political purposes, whatever that purpose be, to buy votes, to punish adversaries, or reward supporters. The fair tax takes those manipulative tools out of politicians' hands, and that is a biggie. But there's something even bigger. The fair tax will put the U.S. on a level trade playing field with China. As a nation, we're engaged in a great debate over the billions of dollars we spend on importing goods from China. A lot of that stuff has lead in it. Maybe you've heard that. After the Fair Tax book came out, Larry Lindsey, he's one of President Bush's early economic advisors, stopped by Congressman Linder's palatial office to point out that we didn't sufficiently emphasize the positive impact this would have on America with regard to imports, particularly from China. Some economists argue that the embedded cost of taxes in the price system on exports is wrung out by the floating exchange rates of the respective currencies. But China doesn't float its currency. The yuan has largely been pegged to the dollar. The fair tax, by eliminating the embedded cost of the tax system, would eliminate the disadvantage that now plagues our locally produced products relative to Chinese imports. It would effectively be a legal WTO-compliant tariff. The Bush administration has been urging China to float its currency for 6 years. What China has been unwilling to do would be accomplished through implementation of the fair tax. With the fair tax in place, we would no longer care whether or not China floats its currency. though we suspect that it would begin to do so again in a fair tax world, because it would be in its own self-interest. And finally, even a larger point, larger than China. In a conversation with President Bush on the fair tax, this most important point was made. He got it. If we were the only nation in the world with no tax component in its price system, jobs and capital would flow into our country. As you've heard, both Treasury Secretary John Snow and Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan say, nobody disputes that. Other nations, in order to protect their jobs at home, would have to change their tax system to a pure consumption tax, just like the fair tax. That would turn their citizens into voluntary taxpayers, taking the coercion out of their tax system. We're talking about spreading freedom across the planet. And if you have a better adjective, let us know. Until then, we're just going to call it amazing. Now it's Chapter 6, Myths About the Fair Tax, and a hint, it's not a miracle. Maybe we should call this the Tough Love Chapter. For all that the fair tax is, there are a lot of things it isn't. We need to dispel some myths, and now is as good a time as any. First, the fair tax isn't the work of a group of tax protesters. We're not trying to eliminate taxes. We are trying to reform the way taxes are collected. We fully understand that taxes are a fact of life. The fair tax isn't a tax cut. It isn't a stealth plan to defund the federal government. Its fair tax rate will need to be set to collect just as much revenue for the operation of the federal government as the current system is collecting today. The fair tax doesn't attempt to reduce government spending, though government spending certainly does need to be reduced. The votes aren't there to try packing both a tax reform and a spending reform plan into one piece of legislation. Our best hope is that the transparency brought about by the fair tax would encourage citizens to become more proactive in their approach to government and what it costs. Then, and only then, will we see a reduction in government spending. The fair tax isn't a cure-all for jobs going overseas, though it's certainly a necessary step in the right direction. There will always be cheaper fingers somewhere out there to do much of the work that needs to be done. Companies might seek lower-cost labor elsewhere, but economists are unanimous in their belief that the fair tax would bring far more jobs, and better-paying jobs at that, to our shores. The fair tax isn't pain-free. As America moves from a consumption economy to a savings economy, there's going to be dislocations. People like to muse about the IRS employees and the tax attorneys who are going to be laid off. Well, that will certainly come to pass, but there will be more. For all of those businesses and even industries that have been profitable because of their advantages in the code, rather than their necessity in the marketplace, well, the fair tax is going to force some important changes if they want to survive. Government largesse is addictive. Breaking addictions can be painful, though necessary. The fair tax is simply a dollar-for-dollar replacement of our current income-based revenue system with a consumption-based revenue system. As a result, it would eliminate all the disadvantages that we as a nation have placed on ourselves through our income tax system. Further refinements, such as decreased government spending, well, that's going to depend on you. It's amazing to us how often we hear this. I'm not going to support the fair tax because it doesn't reduce government spending. That's true. It doesn't. We've already said this, but the thought needs amplification. There are many elected officials who might well tolerate, even support, a proposal to fundamentally change the way our government raises revenue. That is, as long as there's still the same amount of money in the pot as before. These politicians are addicted to spending. Tax dollars buy votes, and votes keep politicians comfortably safe in their positions of power. While the single biggest complaint against the 12-year Republican majority was that it spent too much, it's also true that a significant number of Republicans sided with the Democrats in passing spending bills, especially for education and social programs. Bear in mind that while Congress was run for 12 years with the Republican majority, at no time was there a conservative majority. After implementation of the fair tax, the ball is going to be in your court. As a voter, one of your biggest challenges will be to closely monitor congressional votes on government spending and new government programs. Here, the fair tax will help. In a fair tax economy, you'll have a very special interest in watching your congressman's or senator's votes. If he or she proposes a huge new government entitlement program that would require a tax increase, he or she would have to increase taxes across the board. Everybody would be hit. No favorites, no playing off the poor, no playing off the evil rich, no hiding taxes in a corporate tax code that you'll eventually pay at the retail level anyway. Though the fair tax in itself wouldn't reduce government spending, it would sure have a chilling effect on future increases. When you see how much the federal government takes out of each purchase, we'll believe you'll demand that your member of Congress vote no more often. And if you're unwilling to do that, that comes under the category of your fault. But perhaps the biggest fair tax myth concerns the cost of living and the size of your take-home pay. Since we want to show you how earnest we're going to be about taking on real criticisms of the fair tax, let's jump into debunking this myth right now, both feet. Prices and wages. Now, we've often heard people ask, since the fair tax will lead to increased competition and thus to a decline in prices, won't the cost of living remain about the same as today, while we workers will see a 50% increase in take-home pay? In the fair tax book, we went to some lengths to explain how the concept of embedded taxes works, that they inflate the price of all goods and services we buy in the retail marketplace, and that the fair tax would erase those taxes from the price structure, replacing them with the fair tax. As we said, we went to some lengths. Now we're going to go to great lengths. There are nuances and subtleties in this equation that need to be fully explored. First, the part of the equation dealing with embedded taxes. As we explained in the fair tax book, every single entity that has anything to do with creating, developing, producing, marketing, and bringing a product to the retail marketplace would have a federal tax burden to pay. That tax burden would just be one of the many costs that entity incurs in the course of business, and like other costs, such as the cost of raw materials or capital equipment, that cost would be reflected in the price charged for the work. So far, so good. A steelmaker would incorporate its tax burden into the price structure of the steel it sells to the automaker. The automaker would then incorporate its tax burden into the cost of the automobile that shows up at your dealership. It's all very simple. Now let's introduce a new element to that equation. That element is you, the worker. If you're employed, you are one of the entities we've written about. It takes more than steelmakers to build a car. It also takes people mining the ore, the people working in the steel mill, the workers on the automobile assembly line. Every one of these people has a federal tax burden associated with their labor. And that tax burden would be incorporated into the price that these people charge their employer for their labor. The tax burden, along with all the other tax burdens we've discussed, would then be incorporated into the retail price of the product or service. Now, perhaps you've never really thought of yourself and the work that you do in this light. In the grand scheme of things, you're just another supplier to your employer. He needs your labor just like he needs the raw materials that go into the final product. The suppliers of all of these materials charge your employer a price that leaves them with some profit after their bills are all paid. So do you. And one of the bills that you have to pay is your federal tax burden. There's one stark difference between you and the other suppliers that do business with your employer. Most of these other businesses pay their debts to the federal government on their own. In your case, however, your employer, more likely than not, does it for you by the magic of withholding. Thus, the concept of take-home pay. Generally speaking, the tax components associated with your labor are your federal income taxes, Social Security taxes, and Medicare taxes. All of these taxes would disappear under the fair tax, just as would the federal taxes paid by your employer. Now, the other entities, as we have chosen to call them, involved in bringing your particular product to the marketplace, would be expected to reduce their pricing structure by an amount equal to the taxes that they no longer have to pay. So what effect would that have on you? Well, let's consider a couple of scenarios. In the first scenario, you would reduce the price you charge your employer for your labor by an amount equal to the tax burden you now incur by virtue of your employment. And where would that leave you? Exactly where you are right now. Your take-home pay would become your paycheck. No withholding for federal taxes, no withholding for Social Security or Medicare. Your employer would no longer have to send in those payments to the federal government on your behalf. As far as your paycheck is concerned, you'd be neither harmed nor helped by the implementation of the fair tax. Your actual paycheck for the first pay period would be equal to the last paycheck you received under the old income tax, payroll tax scheme. Your employer would save by reducing the cost of your employment by an amount equal to the money that he would normally have withheld from your check for these federal income taxes, the Social Security taxes, and Medicare taxes, and he would then pass that savings down the line. Eventually, this would lead to a reduction in the price of whatever product or service you're involved with creating. Now for the second scenario. Your employer decides to increase your paycheck by the amount of the so-called matching contribution to Social Security and Medicare. You also decide to keep, rather than surrender to your employer, the amount that's traditionally been deducted for federal income taxes and your half of the Social Security and Medicare taxes. The result? You would start taking home a good bit more every payday. First, there would no longer be a deduction from your paycheck for federal income taxes. Then you would receive that 7.65% your employer has been contributing, right, to Social Security and Medicare on your behalf. Suddenly, you would have a lot more money to spend. In many cases, take-home paychecks would go up by 50% or more. But bear in mind that while your disposable income, your take-home pay, would go up substantially, the fact that you haven't reduced the price of your labor to your employer by an amount equal to your reduced tax burden would mean that your employer will not be able to pass those particular tax savings down the line. To some extent, then, the price of the product or service you're involved with creating wouldn't be reduced by the full amount of the embedded taxes. And why not? Because you're keeping that money to fatten your own paycheck. Now, what we are saying here is that in any case where the employees are willing to allow their current tax payments to be retained by and used by their employers to lower the cost and the price of production, the prices of goods and services will fall by an average of 22%. Conversely, in any case where the products or service prices don't fall by 22%, it would be because workers decide to convert their federal tax burden into personal income, thus experiencing a sometimes substantial increase in their take-home pay. Now, when we first started this fair tax journey, we felt certain that all employees would be willing to stick with the same take-home pay that they have today and allow all of today's tax payments to be removed from the price of the goods and services that they produce. Well, we've been on the road for about 2 years now talking to you at speeches and book signings, and we've learned the shocking truth. You want to keep that money, all of it. You worked for it, you earned it, and you want to keep it. You often don't trust your employer to do the right thing and lower the price of goods, so you'd rather take home a bigger paycheck, even if it means that the price of goods might not go down as much as they otherwise might. With your new, seemingly giant take-home paycheck, you say you'd be happy to pay whatever the new pricing level will be, plus the 23% inclusive fair tax. So what is going to happen here? Are people going to see a huge increase in the amount of each paycheck, or are we going to see that 22% reduction in the cost of goods and services? And the answer is, it's most likely going to be a combination of the two. In some workplaces, the savings will be passed down the line and the cost of the final product will be reduced accordingly. In other cases, the workers will retain their tax burden plus their share of the Social Security and Medicare taxes. Their businesses won't see the prices go down quite as much. And then in some rare cases, an employer might even raise employee salaries by an amount equal to the matching Social Security and Medicare contributions, resulting in not only greatly higher paychecks, but much higher paychecks. Those employers, however, would be able to reduce their prices only by an amount equal to their corporate income tax burden and tax compliance costs, and whatever tax savings have been passed on by other suppliers. Okay, so have we changed the equation? In the final analysis, not really. Reality warns us against promising a universal 22% reduction in retail prices. Remember, though, with that scenario, you don't get any increase in the pay you take home. It's become clear that we're going to see a combination of reduced prices and increased paychecks. In the final analysis, we're dealing with the same fact. On average, 22% of the cost of every product or service you buy at the retail level represents the federal tax burden associated with bringing that product or service to the marketplace. That 22% would be taken out of the equation through a combination of price reductions and increases in take-home pay for working Americans. Then, the application of the 23% embedded fare tax would bring all of our purchasing power back to just about right where we are right now. Any real increase in the price of goods and services would be offset by corresponding increases in the amount of money that we take home from our jobs. But what about corporate greed, you ask? Now, many of you have expressed a concern that some businesses would simply keep their prices where they are even after implementing the fare tax, trying to soak up those extra profits that would come after the embedded taxes fall away. Now, to be honest with you, I was really concerned about this when I first started learning about the fare tax. That was then, this is now. Since then, your responses have answered this concern loud and clear. No business would succeed in maintaining their pre-fare tax prices and simply add the savings to their bottom line. Why? Because you, the consumers, you and your neighbors wouldn't let them. With hundreds of thousands of fare tax volunteers spreading the word day after day, it's increasingly unlikely that any business entity could get by for long anyway with such a scheme. Any business that tried that tactic would soon see their business heading for the dumpster. Of course, that wouldn't keep some businesses from trying. Yep, trying to keep the money and run. The way things look, though, that might be the worst business decision they ever made. And their second-to-last business decision, by the way, just before they start to think about how to liquidate and close their doors. Chapter 7, here we get to it, folks, the criticisms and how to judge the criticisms of the fare tax. Here comes the fun part, the part where we address the more serious criticisms. The goal here is to give you the most honest appraisal possible of the fare tax idea. We know that if we try to make out the fare tax to be something that it's not, or if we allow criticisms to go unchallenged, will only make it more difficult for you to support and promote this tax reform idea. Here are the criteria that we have set for our evaluations of the criticisms. Number one, and this is very important, we want to evaluate the fare tax as it is currently conceived, not as some people would modify it. Number two, we want to evaluate the fare tax in light of the words of praise it frequently receives. And three, we wish to evaluate the fare tax in terms of the serious criticisms leveled against it. With those ground rules, we believe the results will be very interesting, with many criticisms exposed as sour milk many praises exposed as simple fantasy and the fair tax building blocks confirmed as the solid foundation for tax reform that they are. So let's get started. First, can we agree that with very few exceptions, virtually all Americans want tax reform? If you don't fall into that category, we're a little bit curious as to why you're reading this book anyway. Unless, that is, you're one of those who is threatened by tax reform. Now, we're prepared to exempt many politicians and lobbyists here, sadly, because these folks are very happy with our tax system just the way it is. After all, the current tax code, devised by politicians, is thoroughly stacked in their favor. But when it comes to tax reform, we've had more than enough feedback from Americans to name the two goals that most voters share. The tax code should be simple, and it should be fair. Something in the fabric of the American character brings us to these two elements naturally. Try asking a neighbor, a coworker, or family member to describe what a tax code should be. We'd think you'd find simple and fair to be the most common responses. Plenty of people might also answer that taxes should be low. We don't disagree, but that's a different question for a different book. Now let's look beyond average Americans to the professionals for a moment. We chose the word professionals intentionally rather than the more common reference to tax experts. In our view, nobody is more expert on the separation of the American worker from his money than the American worker. You're the expert. No one is more expert on what the citizenry wants in return from the government than the citizenry. But we also wanted the opinions of tax professionals, and consult them we did. These professionals responded by saying that we should evaluate tax reform based on the following principles and criteria: simplicity, fairness, economic growth and efficiency, neutrality, transparency, minimizing noncompliance, impact on government revenues, certainty, and payment convenience. We know what you're thinking. These criteria could have been taken from my radio show or a speech by Congressman Linder. After all, they seem to describe the fair tax to the letter. Well, that's no coincidence, folks. The professionals who developed these criteria started with a blank slate, much like the creators of the fair tax did. They looked at what could be and what should be, rather than simply what is or what is easy. Now, who are these professionals? Answer, they belong to the AICPA. Now, for those of you that don't know, that's the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants. That's right. CPAs made these recommendations on how we should evaluate the fair tax and the criticisms of the fair tax. Though naysayers always assume that CPAs are against tax reform, we've always known that individual accountants get it, and individually, CPAs tell us they're very supportive of the fair tax. Accountants are highly educated and trained professionals. And believe us, they would much rather be doing more productive things for their clients than preparing tax returns. Individual CPAs tell us that with the fair tax, they could be even more successful at helping businesses and individuals plan their financial future than they have been at recording their financial past. In the chapters that follow, we'll examine the fair tax through the lens of these principles, and then examine the critics and the criticisms of the fair tax through the same lens. As we've said, America's economic future is simply too important to have it sidetracked by naysayers. We know where we need to go. These 10 principles help point the way there. As we've used these critics and criticisms to help weigh the soundness of our principles, we find we've always been led to the same powerful conclusion: you're either part of the problem or you're part of the solution. If criticisms pass muster with the principled lens, we'll incorporate them to make the fair tax and all other reforms better. If they don't, then we discard them as the tripe that they are, the machinations of naysayers who would rather defend their turf than move the debate forward. And finally, we'll acknowledge the criticisms that may meet the 10 principles test, but simply move America's economic future in a different direction from the one sought by the fair tax and its advocates. While the direction pointed by these principles is clear, there may be many ways of getting there. We welcome all comers to this race. We have no pride of authorship that requires the fair tax to be the appropriate victor. Our pride is in America, not authorship. The fair tax is merely a means of moving this great country forward and unleashing its economic potential. Okay, this is Chapter 8, The Critics. The wonderful thing about the fair tax is that it is truly a grassroots movement. It is a topic at dinner tables, water coolers across the nation. Anybody who doubts this can simply look at the letters to the editor section of the local newspaper. Those who support the principles of the fair tax and those who oppose them bring the debate to those pages whenever the topic of taxation arises. The depth and breadth of this grassroots debate affirm that the nation is truly ready to engage on this issue and bring it to fruition. For better or for worse, however, much of the information generated about the fair tax and tax reform and replacement in general isn't generated at the grassroots level. The bulk of the information comes from organizations that are pushing their own agendas. In the pages that follow, we want to look at a few of the most notable of such organizations. Americans for Fair Taxation, fairtax.org as it's known on the internet, has clearly been the driving force on the pro-fair tax side, but it's not the only one. We also have the National Taxpayers Union,